Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the November 14, 2017 edition of Ask a Leader. Today, three courageous women bring their skin in the game to take up some tough material. We'll begin with UCI MFA director candidate Melissa Livingston and UCI actor Monica Minix about their brand new play, Is There Life After Birth? This production focuses on the life of the teenage mother and draws in part on the director's own experiences. The play will run from November 17, November 18. If you're listening live, that's this Friday, and the evening, Saturday matinee, Saturday evening. So in the second segment, Danya Alkouli, Syrian-American writer, poet, and spoken word artist, returns to the program to present her recently released self-published anthology of poems entitled Oceans and Flames. We'll be right back after a short station break. Welcome back to Ask a Leader. My first guests are UCI graduate student and director Melissa Livingston and actor Monica Minix, here in advance of their play to be performed this Friday and Saturday, the play entitled Is There Life After Birth? Melissa Livingston is a Master's of Fine Arts Directing candidate at UCI. She holds a BA in theater from St. Edward's University. She is originally from Texas. Before entering graduate school, she co-founded a nonprofit theater in Austin, Texas, serving as co-artistic director for 12 years. She's directed over 20 professional productions and counts among her several accolades Austin's B. Iden Payne Award for Outstanding Direction of a Drama in 2003 and the 2013 Austin Lifestyle Magazine picked for Best Production of the Year. Well, congratulations all over again. So, under UCI director Jane Page's capable tutelage, Melissa's current artistic endeavor is a community collaboration devised theater piece titled Is There Life After Birth? Examining the lives of pregnant teens and teen mothers in Orange County, California's foster care system. Melissa did not grow up in the foster care system, but she was a teen mother. At 17, she gave birth to her son, and he was just 4 months old when she started college. Her struggles of being a young single mother figure in this theater piece and gives voice to other young mothers. She plans to graduate this coming spring with her MFA in directing from UCI. And joining Melissa is Monica Minix, hailing from the Bay Area. Monica attended Pinole Valley High School, then Diablo Valley Community College in Pleasant Hill in the Bay Area. Her work in theater started 12 years ago. With her permission, we'll ask a bit about her child exposure to domestic violence. We'll take her cues. But both Melissa and Monica joined me in studio. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Melissa Livingston and Monica Minix.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Melissa and Monica, respectively. Well, congratulations on your production, Melissa. As the playwright and director, you're teaching us on so many levels, the personal and general demographics, the institutional and all this. You cover quite a bit in this pretty short play. Why don't you please talk about your collaboration, how you crafted the material, developing your seven different characters?
It started this summer. I went to Mary's Shelter, which is the group home here in Orange County, where these young women are living, and I conducted interviews with the staff and with the young women living there, and then transcribed all of those interviews and started pulling information. The play itself is crafted from monologues that I created from the interviews, that is almost word for word verbatim what these young women had to say, and then bringing in word for word text and the cast coming together to devise new pieces. So it was really a collaboration between the seven cast members and myself in bringing to life these young women from the page and from these interviews.
So how did you land there for the place? Is there some reputation, something? I mean, we'll talk about it as an institution later on, but you chose that place for a very particular reason.
Well, I started looking into different organizations that are working with pregnant teens in Orange County.
Which are all over the map, right?
Yes. And Mary's Shelter stood out to me, one, because they are dealing with mostly young women in the foster care system. And the statistics for young women in the foster care system who become pregnant are much higher than for young women who are not in the foster care system. And so I wanted to look at some of the reasons behind that. What are these young women facing? And I also found it very interesting that Mary's Shelter is not just helping these young women with parenting and with what happens while they're pregnant, but also what the future looks like and how can we give them tools to continue to go and succeed in the future. These young women have the opportunity to continue living there with their babies and parent their babies. And so they're not just looking at while they're pregnant and when they give birth, but what does the first few years of their life look like after becoming a mother as well?
Okay. So in talking about the collaboration, I'm always struck by when it's such a heady and a large topic that begs our critical attention and understanding. You sort of have to stop collecting the information. You got to start putting down the play. And as you were saying in preparation for this, just before we went on air, you said, well, there's even the iteration that I had read has been changing. So it's sort of like it's tough to how do you say this is enough material? Now we start making the play. Put the script down. Start having people learn the script.
Well, we had 2 weeks where
we had
2 weeks where we started creating it. And at the end of those 2 weeks, we said, okay, the script is locked. However, since then, we've taken the pieces that we created and reordered it 5 times before we landed on what we believe is the actual show.
That's, I mean, that takes cunning leadership to understand how, where that's where creatively, sort of historical fiction as speaking or whatever, and artistically, what that's it. You're there.
Yeah, I
and
think
it may
so.
Is it going to change a little bit? Is there going to be? Are you going to surprise yourself with what some actors will say?
Well, we're going to try one more thing, new thing tonight. I will say my cast has just been absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
To be able to shuffle things around and just completely be willing to go there with me anytime I had a new. Okay, wait a minute. I think this is in the wrong place. So I think we need to shift this and tell the story in this order now. And they've all been 100% all in. The entire time. Okay, Melissa, let's go. Let's do this.
Well, that's where all that experience in Austin gives you a real grounding and knowing that, and they can rely on that experience.
Yeah, and also I've taken some classes here in devising work under Jane's direction, and so I felt really prepared coming into this project based on the training I've gotten here at UCI.
Well, this play at turns, it really hurts. And more so when we consider what you raise in the play, the collapse of parental support, and there's a predominance of absent fathers, the loss of these girls' childhoods and shortcomings of the foster system. They continue around us, mainly off of our radars. Life before birth is as much an issue as it's a policy concern. So you're saying that you are looking at how this play can convey how there is policy after this. So talk about what you want us to do with this play after you've presented this.
It's been an interesting conversation in the room. And it feels like, I feel like it comes up in the cast multiple times. One of my hopes is that people will be drawn to action. Not everyone can be a foster parent. But there are lots of ways that as an individual person, you can help young people who find themselves in the foster care system. When you look at the statistics of particularly teen pregnancy, 48% of young women in the foster care system become teen mothers. Only 18% of the general population of women who are not in the foster care system become teen mothers. So that tells me that there's something missing in these young women's lives that they're really seeking, and they're finding it in sex, and they're becoming sexually active at early ages. But a lot of group homes in the foster care system have mentorship opportunities where people can come in and offer an hour a week to a young person. Monica's character talks about how she spent 6 years of her life in the foster care system where she believed no grown-ups cared about her at all. And I often find myself wondering, what if someone had just shown up and given her a little bit of attention? What difference would that make?
Well, talk about that, Monica. And then I want to go back. I want to get really proactive with this because I'm thinking by the time they're struggling in foster care, so much maiming has happened. But let's while you're mentioning Monica's character, please take that forward with us, Monica.
So I relate a lot to a lot of the things that my character says, especially in the sense of feeling like nobody cared about her. I don't have any experience with the foster care system, and I do come from a family with a history of domestic violence. Coming from my father, I'm lucky that I have like the world's best mother ever, so I had that as my rock. But there's been times in my life, like as of even last year, where I really believed that there was one person in the world that cared about me. And I'm not even sure how I got to that place, but from my experience, when you get to that place, you really do believe that nobody cares about you. And for me, I did find solace in like my significant other. And I thought that that was the one person that I had in the entire world. So I understand why this young woman, the girl that I'm playing, would have found comfort, because she does explain that she found safety and comfort in a guy that she was dating. And then, well, I don't want to give stuff away.
No, we're not going to do that. In a way, though, this is like a different male in your life. He replaced a disturbing male figure with one. He didn't even have to do that much. He just had to be not toxic and therefore a very positive presence. Yes. In your life as a male.
Yeah. And with my character, with me as a person, I knew my father. I knew who he was, and he was in my life, not in the most positive way. Actually, not in positive ways at all until I was 10. But with the character that I'm playing, her dad left at a very, very early age, and she didn't know who he was at all. So I definitely see where it could be that replacement of needing to fill that space, needing to fill the space of needing someone to connect to and someone to love you, and finding that in the first person that kind of shows you what that is and what that feels like, what it feels like to have someone care about you, which is so incredibly powerful and so painful to not have.
So let's talk then about you. You have that bedrock it bringing to your character. How was it getting everybody else, the other six actors, on board with this heady material, Melissa? And Monica, I'm sure you were helping. Both of you were bringing them all up.
I have one thing to say.
Yes.
At first. I think Monica. Something that we don't realize is, or even something that I don't realize, is how many girls in the cast, while not having full experiences, not having the experiences of the girls that we're playing, a lot of us have experiences that relate to abuse. And it's been really eye-opening to see, one, that these girls that we're playing are from Orange County. They're in our backyard. Like, this is happening. Like, domestic violence is real, and it's serious, and it affects a lot more people than you think it does. And it's been really eye-opening to see the struggles of so many people that are close to me, that are my age, that are my friends, that I didn't realize that we all share.
And while you're talking about that, it occurred to me that, well, it should always occur to all of us, that even though we're going to move through developmentally in a way, socially, emotionally, with the seven actors, and we've got some takeaways. The takeaway might certainly be that we need, if we are seeing something, we ought to be attuned more what's going on around us, because right now there is some, not just sexual predation, but there's some kind of domestic abuse occurring, absent parenthood, and
yes,
childhood's being lost. And so it's sort of incumbent of all of us to be more vigilant than we ever thought we had to be, because it's still happening. We've got more plays to be writing about the ones that are being, that are at risk right now.
Yes, definitely. It's interesting because some of these young women that whose stories we're telling in the play talk about being 10 years old and
or younger
and going to the store at midnight. And where as a society are we allowing that to happen and not letting that raise a red flag? And
there's
say,
some complicity in this child showing up there for, and we, and prop could be getting some, yeah, some suspects. Well, you can't sell certain contraband to younger children, but showing up at midnight's not right.
Showing
yourself
up at midnight to get a bottle of milk and a package of donuts or something because they've gotten some money from home and there's nothing else to eat in the house.
Red flares go.
That
folks.
Should be a red flag to anyone in our society. And yet it seems to be happening and slipping through the cracks.
So as you were saying, these young ladies, they've got a complicated role surviving these challenges and experimenting, moving on to sexually active lives. Sex, as you were saying, it's a coping. Sex is a tradable commodity. Sex is a confusing mix of many things. So tell us more about how your actors are learning their parts.
This kind of work requires for you to really stretch your empathy muscle. And it's
imagination
been...
imagination maybe too.
Yeah.
For those of us that are so protected.
It's true. However, it's interesting, as Monica was saying, how many of the young women in the cast have experiences, while not at this, at the end of the spectrum that the young women in the show do, but that have been touched by abuse or being victim of a sexual predator in some way, shape, or form, or just sexual assault, be it verbal assault, be it actual physical assault,
or
emotional assault. But almost every single young woman in the cast has spoken about feeling victimized sexually at some point in their life already. And so they've been able to take those own personal experiences and then imagine and amplify what that might be. There's been a lot of discussion. I feel like as we've gone through and they've dug deeper into these characters, they have stopped and asked for more information.
Wow.
Because I have over 37 hours of interviews that I did in order to then cull the information for this 40-minute piece. And so there have been a lot of times where we've stopped on a break and one of the cast members has said, "Hey, Melissa, do you know the exact age of this person's boyfriend?" Or, mm-hmm. you know, just some other further detail, and we'll have a discussion about more about what I learned personally. It's also been really interesting that I feel like little details about who these young women are. One of the characters, when I went to interview her, had just gotten these rainbow light up shoes, and she was so excited to show everybody her rainbow light up shoes. And I just found that so interesting that here she is 15 and had a baby, and yet she was also this little girl that wanted to like bounce around and show her shoes.
That point, I want to get to now, actually. But before I do that, I want to let anybody who's just joined us, my guests are UCI MFA directing candidate Melissa Livingston and actor Monica Minix, here in advance of their play to be performed this Friday and Saturday, Is Their Life After Birth. The play will run that the Friday evening, Saturday noon, and Saturday evening. We'll give you all of the specifics here at the end. So I would like to know, what's the word you're using to refer to these particular girls, young ladies? Female's not going to work. Female is belongs in your genetic class or something like that. It can be a sort of a down pegging. But so what terms were you using on the set? And what do you use? What do we take out of here? Because these girls are, these persons are straddling the childhood and womanhood.
They really are. And Monica and I were just talking about this a little mm-hmm. bit, in that we've gone back and forth from referring to them as young women to then also saying these girls. And it's quite interesting because they really are straddling that. They are no longer just a girl, and they're not really women yet, but they're also not just a teen because they are mothers. And in so many ways, these young women in this play were never allowed to be girls. They were never allowed to be children.
And you give us a lot of lurid detail about that that folks will take in the play.
Yes.
It's heart-wrenching.
Yeah, these young women are definitely survivors.
I think that's one of the biggest points and one of the biggest things that I took away and am taking away as an actor is you talked earlier about really having to stretch your empathy muscle, which is accurate. And it's been, I think, a struggle for a lot of us to kind of slough off our emotions dealing with the material because it is heart-wrenching and it is hard. And early on and, you know, slash up until, well, last night, at least one person breaks down in tears per rehearsal because it's really heartbreaking. But we've had the challenge of looking at the material from the perspective of these young women, these girls, who this is all they've ever known. Like, these are their lives, and they've gotten past these horrible traumas, and they are survivors. They're not breaking down. They're not giving up. And it's been really important for us to look at it from that point of view of only knowing this experience and sometimes having to be matter of fact with information that is really, really, really heartbreaking when reading it from an outside perspective.
So I'm curious, Melissa, when you were taking these stories at Mary's shelter, so what was the emotional register of these young ladies giving their story?
Most of the time, they were just very matter-of-fact about it.
Because that, like what you said earlier, that's the life they know.
That's the life they know.
They're not outside looking in and saying, oh, what a wretched start on life.
Yeah. In fact, one young woman, and this is actually a line in the play, says said to me, even though you're living wrong, you don't realize it because you don't know anything else.
Yeah.
So it's not even until they came to Mary's shelter and started getting therapy and seeing how life could be different that they realized, oh, that's not the way I want to live anymore, or that's not how life is supposed to be, or that's not how childhood is supposed to be. That they just didn't know anything else.
So one other sort of outlier question I struggle with this every time there is news. It's puzzling how teenage pregnancy or any other single mother's pregnancy is perceived by many to be a condition involving just her. There's no male part to the situation. How do you two handle that omission in some people's thought processes? These are not divine births.
Exactly.
There's a dude, and the dude isn't around.
I personally experienced that because I became pregnant at 16, and I lived in a very small town in East Texas where everyone knows everyone. And
did everyone know who the male was?
Oh yeah.
Was he a visible partner to you in as the you're carrying this child to term and giving birth?
He actually broke up with me when I was 2 months pregnant, and then we got back together later. But my entire town ostracized me.
Just you.
But yeah, he went on. He dated other women. He dated friends of mine while I was pregnant and finishing high school a year early. So yeah, it's absolutely amazing how we place so much blame and shame on young women because we see them as, we see their pregnancy. We see them carrying the baby. But men can often walk away and continue their lives as if nothing ever happened. And that has very much happened with the young women in this show for the most part. And I think it's a major problem in our society. I think it's how we look at men in in sexual relationships. And I think it's coming out in other ways in the overall national conversation about women and sexuality and in their sexual lives. And looking at, if you look at how many stories are coming out about men who have abused women right now nationally, even if you look at the campaign on Facebook that was Me Too, it's like we're just now starting to say, hey, wait a minute. Men are doing these things. And my hope is that within the world of teen pregnancy and looking at that issue, that we will start to make men more responsible there, too. Because right now
visible and then responsible. Well, I'm going to roll in a couple of questions here as we're going to draw down this interview. Is there are so many breaking news items. I mean, we know it's been going on a long time, but it's really, really in the forefront of the national public consciousness. And so I'm curious about A, how you are incorporating all the sexual predation data coming in from the breaking news, as well as will we have a chance at any of these performances to have some talkbacks and all of us keep processing what's going on in your play and beyond your play?
There will be talkbacks after every performance.
That's great.
We have representatives from the UCI Health Center coming to speak on pediatrics and the health of children and women's health. We also have representatives coming from the Student Wellness and Health Promotions Program and the Sexual and Relationship Health Program, and from CARE, which is the Campus Assault and Resource and Education Center, and then representatives from Mary's Shelter.
Mandy Mount, she or somebody from her office. They're an amazing. And I try to get them on whenever I can. So, and Monica, and what do you want to see happening with that? And how is that the information, the national coverage, sort of folding into the multilog in the...
Well, I think most importantly, what we already talked about, I think I want audiences to not be left off the hook and have to think about the fact that a lot of times women are blamed and men get away without really being scrutinized for their actions. I hope that audiences would at least look at that and see it and have to face it. As well as, I think we said this as well, I hope that audience members later, if they see a young woman who is pregnant, they realize that it's a much more complicated issue than they might have thought at the beginning, and that they see that and have compassion for these young women and for what they're going through and what they're going to continue to go through, yeah, in their future.
So why don't you both give us the details exactly where and when, Friday, Saturday, these opportunities are available to all of us to be a part of.
Friday at 7:30 p.m., we will be performing in Studio 4 on the Arts Campus at UCI. We'll also be performing in the same studio on Saturday at noon. And then at 7:30 on Saturday evening, we'll be performing at Orchard Hills School in Tustin. It's just off Culver.
Off of Culver there. So that's really important. Well, you know from your own experience, there's daunting challenges. So I'm trying to figure out where we can be proactive here in, like, you know, well, maybe there'll be chances in the talk back to talk about how to be proactive, because there's so many sort of band-aids that get put on at the end of this. And so I'm just finding that there's these isolated young females in their home sites, and I don't know how we can break in except for what you mentioned earlier. If we see something that's, and we've got to do math, it's not adding up, that we step up, and perhaps maybe the Wellness Counseling Center has some really good clipboards to send out. I mean, metaphorically speaking, to follow up on that. Because, I mean, it's the same thing with sex trafficking and you know, enslavement in a household. And that's how we covered that here with that Egyptian young lady in Irvine years ago. And it was finally somebody just that everybody saw wasn't adding up. But so not to continue there. So Mary's Shelter. Will there be a representative from Mary's Shelter participating in any of these talkbacks?
Yes, there will be. I believe there will be a representative at every talk back from Mary Shelter.
Okay. Well, good luck with a full and a responsive house for each performance and a really hearty follow through. That's all the time we have. Thank you so much, Melissa and Monica, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
My two guests were UCI graduate student and MFA directing candidate and Melissa Livingston and actor Monica Minix. Here in advance of their play performed this Friday and Saturday, Is There Life After Birth? We'll be right back after a very short station break with writer, poet, and spoken word artist Danya Alkuli with her latest anthology of poems entitled Oceans and Flames. Don't go away. Jolin Kumbo by Lorraine Klassen, a South African artist living in the Toronto area with her West African ensemble. Welcome back to the show. Returning to the show is my next guest, Danya Alkuli, Syrian-American writer, poet, and spoken word artist. Last year, when she was introducing Syrian culture and history in the early years of the Syrian conflict, that was way back, Danya, 2015, and it's only gotten to be more despicable what's happened to your forebears in Syria. Well, Danya Alkuli is a Southern California native raised by her Syrian immigrant parents. With an affinity for English literature, Danya experimented with poetry and creative writing and eventually submitted poetry to contests. At 15, she received her GED and completed community college in 1 year. From her study of literature, creative writing, she shifted her focus to sociology and child development family studies, graduating at 19 with her BA from California State University, Long Beach. She published her very first book, a poetry book entitled 91 at 19, consisting of 91 of her best poems that were written up at the age of 19. Danya then began working at a social services agency in Anaheim, Access California Services, the exposure of which sent her back to Cal State University, Long Beach, where she completed her master's in public policy and administration. Her passion for writing continues as she works on two novels and her blog, Lady Narrator. Her latest endeavor is an anthology of her poems entitled Oceans and Waves, illustrated by Syrian-American artist Sama Ware, the design by Syrian artist Dima Arabi Katbi. This publication is the subject of today's program, and she joined us today from, is it Huntington Beach, Danya?
It is, yeah.
Well, welcome back to the show, Danya Alkuli.
Thank you for having me.
Well, congratulations, Danya, on this tender, knowing, revealing, and courageous telling of your story in Oceans and Flames. It's remarkable timing with sexual predation, which we were also talking about in the first segment of the show, but it's still around. It's still looming. It's on everyone's radar. Interesting setting in which to launch your book, don't you think?
Absolutely. I wasn't actually even planned that way, but I did want to release it in October in honor of Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and then all of a sudden this just started surfacing in the news, and it just became so overwhelming, but like you said, correct timing.
It's amazing timing, but of course, anybody worth their salt knows it's just an awareness that's in front of us, but it's been going on forever, and that's that lack of precision is intentional. So, well, I want to know, with these exquisite pieces, your compositions, were they first journal entries and then they became poems, or how does that work?
Initially, I was just kind of writing down thoughts after my experience, trying to put together what I was going through, and then I realized that some of these kind of flowed in a way that I wanted it to be poetry, and there was no intention to make it into a book. It was just personal expressions, and then I thought, well, why not? Why not compile it into a book of poetry that expresses these subjects that are often, you know, undiscussed?
Okay, and so in preparation for this interview, you offered to me personally that this is fraught territory for a Muslim woman to to enter into, were there models of written material, models of discourse that inspired and maybe even supported your formally presenting this work?
Not necessarily. For me, it was starting to see women, you know, gravitate towards hearing more about this and seeing like, okay, someone is talking about it, so I want to hear more. And I thought, okay, I think this needs to be brought up. You know, it took me a couple of months before I could start to even talk about what I went through, because it took me months before I accepted that what it was domestic violence and abuse. And, you know, the more I started talking about it, the more I started realizing people need to hear this. So once I started to write poetry that was surrounding the end of my healing process and realizing that I'm ready, I've decided to put together this book and just share it so that other people had, you know, that platform to relate to.
So somewhere along the line then, without your having some kind of a scaffold to build onto, you're building the scaffold. So I guess you consciously at some point realized, well, you're the one that's structuring this, and others are going to build on your shoulders.
I would hope so, and I'm not denying that there are so many other people that have built, you know, their own platforms as well. For me, it was just the way that I had to go through it, the way that I had to deal with all of it. I felt like I had to do this on my own right now. You know, a lot of times this subject is so, you know, swept under the rug. It's very taboo. So for a while, and even till today, I still get people who try to silence it, who try to deny that, you know, it wasn't what I'm labeling it. It's not, you know, abuse or sexual assault. Even with the whole, like, Me Too campaign that was going on social media, you'd see the people that were saying, well, maybe they're just exaggerating it, and that's not what it was. And so for me, I had to face that battle on top of, you know, dealing with the divorce and dealing with trying to find myself again. So I honestly, yeah, I feel like I am building a different platform that other people can, you know, hopefully utilize to understand what they're going through as well.
Well, given these reactions to what you're presenting, tell us who are the readers that you are trying to reach?
Well, I'm trying to reach, first and foremost, a lot of the women and men that do experience this but can't put it into words. A lot of women have reached out to me, and they wanted kind of like someone to justify what they were feeling. You know, I had women that reached out to me saying, I'm not sure that this is abuse, but from what you're talking about, from what I'm reading about your poetry, it sounds like it. So can you help me to clarify? And that really shook me, because I thought, wow, we have to talk to someone else to get, you know, validation to accept that what we're going through is not okay. We can't even take our own internal intuition telling us, okay, this is not right. So I'm reaching out to those people who feel alone, because for a while that's how I felt. You know, I'd reach out with help, but very vaguely ask the question, and people will be like, oh, this is normal. You know, it's hard to deal with a relationship and a marriage. You just have to kind of go with the flow and it'll fall into place. Another group that I'm trying to reach is just the general public, to start feeling comfortable to talk about this. You know, it's not something that should be hidden or shushed or, you know, filtered. That was another thing I faced. It was like, okay, well, if you are going to talk about abuse and domestic violence, kind of talk about it in this light and make it, you know, a little more easier to digest. And I thought, no, there's nothing easy to digest about this. We're either going to tackle it whole, or we're just going to continue on this tradition of silencing it. So it is geared to a variety of audiences, so that this becomes more discussed and then not just talked about, because I'm also really tired of us just talking about things. We need to take action. And so that is why I'm continuously pushing this book and trying to get, you know, the tours going and things like that.
Let's talk about the really special structure of your book and the form that you're striking. So each, and I don't know, what do you call each piece on the page? That's the first thing I wanted to understand.
Each piece is a poem.
Okay, and so each poem, it's then given, it's a date at the end of each poem, and I'm not as familiar as I want to be about the Quran, but I was wondering if you're trying to sort of emulate the flow, the form, the layout of each of the pages on the Quran.
No, that's a really unique way to look at it, but it wasn't intended that way. The dates attached to each poem at the very end are actually the dates that I wrote that piece.
Yes, I figured.
And because I initially started writing them just for myself, I wanted to document, you know, okay, on this day, this is what I was feeling, and this is what I was filtering through emotionally. So when I decided to put together the poem, I thought the date is really significant. It is a part of this piece. I don't want to eliminate it. I usually date all of my poems just for the sake of documentation. And in the previous publication, I did not put the date. But this time, I felt like the dates were very meaningful to these poems. Each one signifies, like, this is the day that I marked. This is what I was going through. This is what I went through. This is what I handled.
And the chronology for the listeners is that the temporal chronology is mixed up, so that the most recent entry is probably about one of the quarter back from the end, and there, you know, 2013 is dispersed throughout the publication. So it's a matter of what, I guess, it's the flow of your thinking, not the time flow, as it were. For those of you who are just joining us, my guest is Danya Alkhouli, Syrian-American writer, poet, and spoken word artist, talking about her recently released self-published anthology of poems entitled Oceans and Flames, illustrated by Syrian-American artist Sama Ware. So let's first have you talk a little bit about your collaboration with Sama. Could you talk about the process there and how you were mediating various messages and your relationship to one another and putting this together?
Absolutely. Sama and I go way back. We call each other soul sisters. There's just so much. We've grown up together, and, you know, we've shared so much together. And when I was putting together this book, I felt like I want something just as powerful as the words attached to each piece. And so I reached out to Sama, who was an amazing artist and my best friend, and so I told her, you know, this is what I want to do, and I feel like I need a powerful image to associate with each poem, and I cannot draw for the life of me. So I had told her that each poem, I would tell her what I want, sketch-wise, and she could just be creative and, you know, create whatever comes to mind related to the piece that I was describing to her. And so it took a couple of months of going back and forth. I'd give her, you know, half, like a couple of the poems. She'd work on it. We'd review. And honestly, she did a magnificent job of capturing the images that I wanted for each poem. And it showed the pain. It showed the progress. And so, you know, through communication, we were able to put that together. And it was amazing because she got to do all of this still while going to Greece to work with refugees and while, you know, working full time. So she was able to put, you know, to bring to life what I wanted in my poems still while going through her work.
Everything you say is absolutely the case, that it's almost on even footing. And I'm not to take away anything from your careful word construction and creation, but it's every single drawing really is its own sort of editorial piece. It's an amazing pairing. I mean, congratulations for both of you in that way you've collaborated so successfully. So
she is amazing. So she got what I wanted. I mean, when I saw the first, you know, copy come to me, I was really floored. I thought, yeah, she really put together exactly what I wanted.
So did you give her individual poems to illustrate, or did you give her the flow of the book and so she went along the kind of chronology of your publication?
No, it was individual poems. Each one I actually had put like a post-it with an explanation of, well, this poem, this is what I'm trying to capture. Some poems I even had an exact image in mind. I just told her, this is exactly what I want for this piece, and she'd make it.
It is phenomenal. Well, this is the part where the host asks the guest, would you please select a couple excerpts from Oceans and Flames and tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. One of the poems that I've been reading a lot, especially with what's going on in the news, is called Mind Over Body. And it actually talks about sexual assault. And it was very difficult for me to actually read it the first few times, just because I don't think it was hard for me personally, but it was just hard to see the reactions of people and what they would, you know, feel about it. So that's one of the really strong pieces that I do like to share wherever I go.
And it's really, that's an uncanny illustration that accompanies that too. So please read on, Mind Over Body. It's September
22, 2015. Yes. Okay. You don't deserve my body until you earn my mind. I should have said that to him. I should have recognized my own worth that moment. I should have found the courage to throw away 24 years of overzealous humility to save myself, but I couldn't. He didn't even ask. He just took it. Everything. He stole a kiss from me, and I mean that phrase in every sense of literalism. He stole a kiss. Stole. What an ugly phrase we've learned to romanticize oh so well, that women have learned to fear fighting back when their bodies are being taken. That women have learned it's more ladylike to let him have his way instead of saying stop. To cry for hours later on the drive home in shame and fear. That women have learned to research methods of abortion and set aside enough money to cover the cost of morning after pills because he can't even be man enough to protect you. You. Even that's awful. You women are the ones in need of that protection, because who else will go down when an unwanted or unexpected pregnancy happens? Yes, I am a feminist. No, I am not a man hater, but I hate that kind of man, and I hate that man who silenced me in the dark if he did what he wanted. That was the one night I tried to push him away. I cried. My body did too. Still, he didn't stop. He never earned my mind. He hated my mind. He tried so hard to break it, and he almost succeeded until I made up my mind. Walking out the door and never looking back has been the greatest memory I keep. But what haunts me is the reality that no man seems to carry the ability to blow my mind without needing my body as the mechanism. So until then, you don't deserve my body if you can't earn my mind.
It's so phenomenal, Danya. It's. I think worthy of an opinion editorial publication. Just the poem. Are you contemplating? Would you contemplate that?
I don't know. I never really thought about it.
Because it gives such articulate expression to that duality and the asymmetry of the power in play between a man and a woman with the highest absolute stakes. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. So for those of you who've just joined us, we're listening to Danya Alkhouli, Syrian American writer, poet, and spoken word artist. She's reading a segment of one of the pieces in her self-published, recently released Oceans and Flames. Did you want to say a bit more about, you've practically said it all, but maybe there's something more you wanted to give some additional context.
Honestly, I don't know if there's anything more. I just really do hope that this book is a step in the right direction towards raising the awareness that's needed, especially within my community, the Muslim and Arab communities, just so that we become more comfortable to talk about it and we become more comfortable hearing women and men express their experiences with this, so that we do start taking action. That's kind of what inspired me to start. I'm reapplying to school right now in hopes of starting a PhD in sociology of culture to tackle this problem on a more academic level. And so I'm hoping that this is that platform for me as well to take the next step.
So what are the reactions that you're getting with your book now released? Because you're on a book tour, and we'll find out too where people can meet you and have their book signed and support you. So what are the reactions as you're moving about with your book?
It's been really, really positive and supportive, and I'm truly honored and excited to see such positive feedback from, my community, my friends, my family. Even when I go out and perform in different venues and I express this, it's been such a positive response. And I think it's because people are now starting to realize that this needs to be talked about. It's such a relief to see that not only is it being discussed, but now someone has put it in a book of poetry. And I do get that some people do end up questioning, like, how does that work? How could you put into poems domestic violence? And they start to question it. then I end up, you know, talking about my backstory. Well, this was really just my experience. And I, as a poet, I've always been putting life into words. And it just made sense that I would put this experience and, you know, these changes that I've gone through into words. And I realized, okay, why do I need to keep this to myself? I can share it with others. I can help others to the best of my ability and put it into the public.
And are you in a position where you're saying, well, just because it's a taboo in Muslim culture doesn't mean it's not happening, folks?
Absolutely.
I mean, it is a taboo because it is happening. That's the other side of the coin, right? That's human nature. So where can people meet you, Danya? Where can I meet you again? I meet you at a lot of refugees welcome and other kind of Syrian American come togethers. But so what about book tours now that you're involved with?
So I'm still coordinating the next few dates. I actually just got invited to the East Coast. I'm working on that for the spring, but at the moment, I'm doing kind of like just different readings across LA. There's nothing set in schedule, but I do post all of the information about future dates and events on my social media. So you can look up Lady Narrator on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, and that's usually where I'll post, you know, the next dates for different
Excellent.
Events, next performances, and you know, updates on the book.
Excellent. All right. Well, then we'll make sure people know how to do that. So. Well, I want to congratulate you one more time, and it's also gratitude I want to post you, because there is such refined attention given to such personal, intimate material. It gives us everything to work from and to understanding, and it has a kind of a manual, a how-to. If you recognize this, then therefore you know it's not right, and it's time to address it and get the support to get out of whatever situation one is in.
Right.
Well, so Danya.
Thank you.
Danya Okwuili, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Claudia.
Danya Okwuili is a Syrian American writer, poet, and a spoken word, talking about her Oceans and Flames show. So we're going to wrap the show. I guess I'll just mention that the Refugee Student Scholarship Program is going to have a fundraiser on the 16th. That's Thursday. You want some information? There is the Scholars Program Fundraising Banquet. Go to the Refugee Student Scholarship Program, funded by Access California Services. I'll see if I can get you a link for those of you who might be interested in attending Thursday. That's my wrap. Talk with you next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening.